couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about a new movie that's out this week, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, with a special guest reviewer. And I'm also going to be talking about the Stranger Things-inspired reviews of Daryl from 1985 and Frankenstein's Monsters, Monster Frankenstein. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring The Reptile and Universal Horror Collection Volume 2. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Two times I got to say rest in peace this week, and the first one goes to David Hedison, who was 92 when he passed away. Now, the thing I'm seeing most credited as in these articles written about him is that he was the original The Fly in the 1958 version of The Fly with Vincent Price. He was the guy who gets turned into a fly. But you know what I remember him from most is I remember him as Felix Leiter in a series of Bond movies. And what's funny is if you go back to the character Felix Leiter, I think he's had more people playing him than James Bond himself. He starts off in like one of the earlier episodes, like one of them he's played by Jack Lord, I think. And then another guy plays him. He's the guy who plays the chief from Get Smart. And those guys don't look anything like each other at all. They don't even try. I mean, at least with James Bond, they're like, okay, we're going to recast him. We're going to make him a good looking, tall, debonair, dashing spy. But, you know, all the versions of Felix Leiter look totally different. That's how I always remember him, as the quintessential Felix Leiter from the 70s and 80s. And so it's sad to see him go. And he was a character actor who was on everything. I mean, he was on like soap operas and guest spots on everything from The Love Boat to major motion pictures. So, yeah, he was a big name character actor in Hollywood. And, you know, it's sad to see him pass. The other rest in peace has to go to Rutger Hauer, who died at age of 75 this week. You know, he was such an imposing force in movies. I mean, of course, everyone remembers him from Blade Runner. That's probably the one that I think most people are recognizing him from. But I always grew up with him in Lady Hawk, which is a fantastic movie with Matthew Broderick and Michelle Pfeiffer. He did some smaller, goofy, sort of almost direct-to-video stuff like Blind Fury with Meg Foster back in the early 90s, I think. And he kind of resurged his career. He showed up in other movies later on. For example, he did that Hobo with a Shotgun, which was a grindhouse movie starring him that was kind of put together just for, you know, kind of like a fake trailer come to life. You know, like anyone, he aged, but I always thought he had a great screen presence. And it was kind of a shock because I don't think anybody knew about it. They announced it like a week later that he had passed away. But yeah, again, sad to see Rutger Hauer go. Two people I remember watching in a lot of movies and television when I was a kid, and that's sad. The other big piece of news that happened this week, and I could talk about all this little Comic-Con stuff with Star Trek and Picard and you know, dovetailing into the Quentin Tarantino movie and whether or not Quentin Tarantino is ever actually going to do a Star Trek movie. Spoiler alert, he won't. He has a bigger minefield of movies that he's not made than movies he's made. And that's whether or not you count Kill Bill as one movie or two. Spoiler alert, it's two. It's never been put into a single film. Anyways, the big news out of Comic-Con, though, was that Marvel announced their Phase 4, the post-Endgame version of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it's pretty ballsy, I gotta say. I mean, one of the things that's most interesting is yeah, they're developing movies, and like they got a Black Widow standalone film, everybody knew that was coming up next, but the thing that I found most interesting is they're tying a lot of this to the Disney Plus streaming service, and that includes series for Loki, Hawkeye, Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and the Scarlet Witch and Vision. All of those are getting live-action Disney Plus shows, and that's important because, you know, you can sit there and say, well, yeah, they did Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., and they have a couple cameos on that, and, you know, Coulson sort of was the tie between, but those are minor characters. I mean, you're talking about major players in the Avengers universe getting their own TV show. They're really throwing down for Disney Plus. They want people to look at it. And I just hope that Disney isn't like requiring you to have to watch those to follow the cinematic universe. And I don't think they will, because you're going to cut out part of your audience doing that. You should still be able to just watch the movies and get by, just as you don't have to watch Daredevil or Jessica Jones or Luke Cage or anything like that to continue to watch the Avengers movies. But the movies that are coming out, they've got, of course, the Black Widow movie, and then they got the Eternals, which is one of those out there bizarre movies, but hopefully it has the same oomph and excitement and catches the imagination of the world that Guardians of the Galaxy did. But you got like Angelina Jolie, Kumail Nanjiani, and Salma Hayek in that. They're also putting together a Shang-Chi and the Legend of Ten Rings movie. The big news, I think, that really kind of took a lot of people by storm, and of course angered a lot of people, even though it was telegraphed in the comics years ago, Natalie Portman is returning to the Thor universe as the female Thor. Now, how they work that in from her being this sort of nerdy but beautiful scientist who's really not much of a fighter physically in the other movies to making her the God of Thunder, who knows? But I'm curious to see how they do that. And of course, Valkyrie is going to be an LGBT character. She's going to be a lesbian or at least bisexual. That's not a big surprise. You can watch Valkyrie in some of the things that she does, especially in Thor Ragnarok, and be like, yeah, that I can see that coming. And then the final one is, of course, the Doctor Strange sequel that will be featuring the multiverse, and it's being billed as a horror movie directed by Scott Derrickson, whose roots are in horror movies, stuff like Sinister. So I'm looking forward to that, as well as also Mahershala Ali as the new Blade, which is neat. And they're going to be bringing back Fantastic Four, so they're doing what everybody expected, the good things that Disney was going to do when it absorbed Fox, as opposed to the bad things that everybody worried about. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to hit is Harriet, and it's award season, so here we go. It's about Harriet Tubman, and it opens on November 1st.
I don't know if you know how extraordinary this is, but you have made it 100 miles to freedom all by yourself. Would you like to pick a new name to mark your freedom?
Harriet Tubman. If I'm free, my family should be too. I made up my mind, I'm going back. You're confident, composed. When trouble comes, you'll be ready. I made it this far on my own, so don't you tell me what I can't do.
I'm really looking forward to this because not enough people know what kind of a person Harriet Tubman was. And she was someone to be reckoned with. She was stern and she knew what she was doing and she was opinionated and she pushed and she did some amazing things. I mean, you look at the pictures, everybody's seen pictures of her, but she looks old and ragged and she looks like she can barely walk across the room. But this woman walked to freedom and she would take people to freedom, and she helped organize that Underground Railroad. And I mean, she was not somebody to mess with because she would threaten to shoot people if they were trying to say they're going to go back, because she's like, no, you made this decision and you're going to jeopardize all of us. So, I mean, she had some tough decisions to make and she was committed and she's a true American hero. And that's something that I really want to see in a movie, and she deserves to be on the 20. So let's get that happening too. The other one I want to hit really quickly is It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, which opens on November 22nd.
Mr. Rogers,
I'm here to interview you.
It is so nice to meet you.
You okay?
Profiling Mr. Rogers.
Boyd, please don't ruin my childhood.
This piece will be for an issue about heroes. Do you consider yourself a hero?
We are trying to give the world positive ways of dealing with their feelings.
Of course, on the heels of the Mr. Rogers documentary from last year, Won't You Be My Neighbor, we've got Tom Hanks playing Fred Rogers in a biopic. And I mean, this looks charming and all. It looks like it's stealing a lot of the same beats from Won't You Be My Neighbor, mainly because it's about Fred Rogers' life. And you can't really stylize it too much because he's Fred Rogers and a lot of people knew how he was, and you can't shoot it like a Michael Bay movie. But it looks charming and wonderful, and I'll probably enjoy it and love it as much as I did Won't You Be My Neighbor, which brought me back to my childhood as a little kid watching Mr. Rogers before I got too old and cool for that. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. These are going to be two contenders for award season, I hope. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Daryl and Frankenstein's Monsters, Monster Frankenstein. back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the reviews section. But first, before I get to the big movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I wanted to cover a couple smaller ones, some more obscure stuff, stuff that I like to see. And I watched Stranger Things season 3 a couple weeks ago. I loved it. And it has inspired me to do other things and to watch other things. Of course, last week I reviewed some of the movies they had on the marquee. I'm going to be reviewing one of those later in the segment, which is Daryl. And then there's also something that has a connection to David Harbour, and that is Frankenstein's Monsters, Monster Frankenstein. David Harbour plays a fictional version of himself, delving into his fictional father's artistic obsession.
40 years ago, my father, David Harbour Jr., conducted the noble experiment of producing plays for television.
Don't get too close!
We've been logging that footage, looking for insight into my father.
He bit off a lot with this play.
You're pretending to be me, Dr. Frankenstein, while I pretend to be the life that you've created in order to secure funding from her who represents the Research Institute.
Did my father have a compulsion to court disaster?
It's taking so long, I'm hungry. You give me cold beef.
There's a lot of things about your father you may not want to know.
I told you not to dig.
First of all, let's explain what that title is. It's the story about Frankenstein being the monster's monster. So it's a monster to the monster. Frankenstein is such a monster to Frankenstein's monster. It's a play on words, and it's crazy. But also, before I even go on about that, can I dispel this misconception where they say, well, Frankenstein is the doctor and the monster is the monster. The monster's not Frankenstein. Ah, but it is. If you have an offspring, that offspring takes your surname. My name's Kevin Carr. I have a son named Liam. He takes my name. He is Liam Carr. Frankenstein created life. He created a being. Whatever that being's first name is, Chad or Steve or Horatio, his last name would be Frankenstein because he is, in essence, the son of Dr. Frankenstein. Ergo, Frankenstein's monster is Frankenstein. It might be Chad Frankenstein, but it's Frankenstein. So this business of being that guy who comes in and goes, well, actually, you know, the monster is the monster, not Frankenstein. Nope, you're wrong. Idiot. Anyways, in Frankenstein's Monsters, Monster Frankenstein, it's a mockumentary, and it's like 32 minutes long, and it's this weird little piece of art, almost a performance art by David Harbour. And what it seems to be, I almost think what happened in the background is he's like, hey, guys, I've done 3 seasons of Stranger Things. Can I shoot this really stupid thing? Can you give me a minimal budget and I'll make this little video and you can promote it with one of the seasons of Stranger Things and maybe enough people will watch it? Because it feels like it was shot for the BBC, but it's supposed to be shot for American Playhouse kind of thing, only it would have been something that was taking place in the 80s. And the father is sort of an Orson Welles type character, of course, played by David Harbour himself, not really even going far to make himself look terribly different. It is a weird little movie, but it's funny. It's not something that everybody's going to get because it has some very dry humor. It's very much an American production, but it feels very British in a way, not just because of the BBC look to it with it being shot on videotape and then cutting to the, you know, high def interviews of him trying to recreate his dad's office space and talking to his old agent. Not just because of the video look of the filmed pieces, which look very much like a Doctor Who set. It doesn't wink and nod at the audience. It delivers it completely seriously. And Americans don't always catch that humor. I honestly feel this feels very British, even though it's an American piece. It's weird and but it's funny. It's worth that half hour. I mean, look, there's worse things you can do for a half hour in this world. And I'm not going to list them on the radio because some of them I would get in trouble for. But anyways, it's kind of hard to explain because it has these interviews and these flashbacks and it shows the insanity of actors from an actor's perspective. And that's kind of fun to watch. And plus, it also gives a little look into the twisted mind of David Harbour, who I think was the one who put this together, or at least spearheaded it. So I'm going to have to say Frankenstein's Monsters, Monster Frankenstein kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with Daryl. A foster child and his family discover he's actually a highly intelligent synthetic genius.
He's a mystery and a miracle.
He's just a little boy, flesh and blood, isn't he?
with a past he doesn't remember.
Daryl is an experiment in artificial intelligence.
Are you really my mom and dad?
And powers he doesn't understand.
You're now saying it can feel human emotion.
Yes. He experiences pleasure and pain.
The government designed him.
You're asking us to destroy a child.
I actually saw Daryl in the theaters in 1985. What's funny is all those movies on the marquee, most of those I saw in 1985. And Daryl was a movie, again, I was like 13 when that movie came out. I was almost 14. I was really a good age for that. And it's funny because I showed it to my kids, and my youngest is 11, and he was at a good age for that, so he understood it. Now, it stars Barrett Oliver, who is sort of a Will Wheaton lookalike from that age. He was in Neverending Story. He was also in Cocoon. Both movies are mentioned in Stranger Things season 3. But he had this, like, 2 years, he was, like, the child actor in, like, 1985. He was like the Cameron Bright of his age. If you remember who Cameron Bright was, who was this guy in the mid-2000s, like 2005, was in, like, every movie that had a kid in it. But this movie is highly imperfect. This movie is incredibly flawed. It is one of those films that, and you could do this in the 80s. This doesn't quite work nowadays, but you could do this in the 80s where you have sort of this action sequence opening, which introduces him. And then it just turns into a kid living with a family as a foster child. He's just very gifted in computer work and he's athletic. So he shows that he has certain abilities, but really it's just kind of this family, not even a comedy, but a family drama about this kid working with his foster family. And then about halfway through the movie, it suddenly kicks into gear with the government coming after him and saying, hey, this is stuff you know going into the movie, because his name is it's an acronym and I forget what it stands for. But, you know, if you watch the trailers, it's saying, yeah, he's basically a robot. He's an android. He's a synthetic life form that is brilliant, but he was hiding in plain sight. And it feels like it's got a lot of connective tissue with stuff like War Games or it's not quite the Goonies, because the Goonies were more for sort of like the adventure type thing. But the kid or the family that's running from the government, or even something like Starman. I mean, you had all these things where you had these special characters, whether they were space aliens or whether they were robots or whether they were just mutant types, like even like something like Escape from Witch Mountain. That's kind of what this is like, about this kid who's on the run, who's very special, and it fits with, it almost feels like it should have had a book. I don't think it's based on a book, but it feels like it should have been a kid's book that was then adapted into a movie. And, you know, it's cute. It's highly, like I said, it's highly imperfect. It does not hold up. The 47-year-old Kevin watching this had a very different reaction than the 13-year-old Kevin watching this in 1985. So I have to say it's an interesting movie. It's kind of fun, but I have a hard time saying it kind of rocks. I'm going to have to say it kind of sucks, because it just doesn't hold up as a movie could from the 80s.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
Anyways, that's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood with special guest reviewer Sterling. Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews with the only new movie that's out this week, and that is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino's latest film. And I thought that I'd bring in a guest reviewer for this one, partly because he was there with me when we saw the movie, so that I knew that he wasn't going to welch on it and not be able to see it. So, you know, he's physically there. My good friend Sterling, who is a radio personality from various areas, but he's also Stick, I'm Chubby, and the Chubby and Stick podcast. podcast. You heard me talk about it a little bit last week. You can search Apple Podcasts for Chubby and Stick. You can go to the Fat Guys at the Movies page and find the Chubby and Stick podcast. But welcome to the show, Sterling.
Well, I'm glad to be on the show. I'm not normally a guest, so this is like an unusual circumstance.
Well, before we hit the review, tell people who you are, what you do, and if they want to find you, how they find you, or anything like that, because, you know, we go way back, but I know you,
yes.
But a lot of people who listen to the show don't necessarily.
Right. I do a weekend talk show on 700 WLW in Cincinnati on iHeartRadio and do fill-ins for other stations. We do Chubby and Stick together, and otherwise I just sort of meander around planet Earth and try to make sense of things. That's basically the scenario. And I watch a lot of movies and a lot of TV, and if I can't get out of leaving the house, I try not to leave the house.
How do you meander around the world and Earth, walking the Earth like Kane from Kung Fu, yet never leave the house? How does that work?
I have found a small hell dog. I like to call him Crazy, and he does not like to stay in the yard. So we walk, and then we have adventures, or he has adventures, and we just observe things. That
sounds like an adorable
it.
Saturday morning cartoon.
It could be. If you could work that out for me, I'd love some Saturday morning cartoon money, actually. That would be great. Let's call Cartoon Network post-haste.
We'll jump on that. But first, let's talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's Quentin Tarantino's latest film, in which Leonardo DiCaprio plays a declining actor in the final years of the golden age of Hollywood, while Charles Manson and his family lurks in the background of Los Angeles.
So, Rick, explain to the audience exactly what it is a stunt double does.
Actors are required to do a lot of dangerous stuff. Cliff here is meant to help carry the load.
My hands are registered as lethal weapons. We get into a fight, I accidentally kill you, I go to jail.
Anybody accidentally kills anybody in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter.
There was a lot to put into that blurb. I had to cram it because it is about, in a way, about the Manson family, but that's not what the movie's about.
It's a typical Tarantino thing in that he weaves in and out of multiple storylines that then interact or cross paths over a period of time, and it's 1969 LA. And that's one of the things that I found cool about the movie is that you are seeing, it's almost like a period piece of all the aesthetics, the music, which is always amazing in a Quentin movie, and all the stuff that goes along with it, and really some amazing performances. The only thing I have to say about it in this regard is maybe negative, is it seems like it's sort of drawn out, but they are incredible moments and scenes. I feel bad saying something bad, especially the first time I'm on the Fat Guys thing.
Just come and stick it to him in the first review that you've ever done on the show.
I need to see it again, and that's weird to say for a movie that's 2 hours plus. It was drawn out, but every scene was amazing to look at. Every sound was amazing to hear. It just seemed like it could have maybe been compressed, but I want to see it again. So I guess that means maybe I really like the movie, and boy, is there some good stuff with dogs.
That's the thing with this film. There's some great stuff, and you could almost say that about any Quentin Tarantino movie. I would not call this a great Tarantino movie. You know, it has the interlocking storylines, but unlike Pulp Fiction, where Pulp Fiction takes these multiple storylines that interconnect, and they interconnect brilliantly.
They do.
And it's just kind of jaw-droppingly amazing to see how things just wrap around and weave through everything. This is more, it's all kind of just thrown into the mix, and they're connected, but they don't have that linking that you saw. The other thing with this, let's talk about the period piece element to it, too. You're right, it is that, but it's the way that 70s show wasn't really about the 70s. It was more dumping everything that was 70s into Eric Foreman's basement and shaking it up.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what I felt with this one, is that they put so much nostalgia to it. I don't think Los Angeles 1969 was exactly like that. I wasn't there, but I don't think it was like that. It's what people growing up watching movies from that era, Quentin Tarantino, thought L.A. was in that time.
I think that's probably fair. I wasn't there either, a little earlier than I had hatched. But it was certainly an amalgamation of all those things that you think, Summer of Love, you think, as all of it sort of comes crashing down, which is also about what this Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is, because there's a changing of the system of Hollywood, aging actor, and all these weird things and innocence sort of going away in multiple generation things, too. That was the interesting thing I found, is that you saw this collision of generational peoples and the good and the bad and the very evil, ugly bad of that as well.
I find it hard to say what the story is, because it really is about DiCaprio's character, but it also is not. Right. I mean, there are parts that are like heavily into the, and that's an interesting arc there. But it, even within that arc, it just swerves out of it all the time and back to it. And Brad Pitt, who plays a stuntman, has almost a little bit more of a archetype character, more of a character you'd see in a movie than a real character of an aging actor who's struggling with his own inability to allow himself to be good.
Yeah, well, I mean, you sort of see that aging with him, too. See, I thought that was really well done as far as both sides of that. They give you more angles at DiCaprio's Rick Dalton than Cliff Booth for Brad Pitt. But you see it, and there's the narration issue. And then there's some other performances that are sort of in and out of there that I thought were really kind of awesome as well.
I am going to be critical about one thing. Margot Robbie plays Sharon Tate,
yes.
and that's a key role to it. And I remember there were complaints about this from the press, the journalists in sort of like woke film Twitter, about how little dialogue she has in the trailer. It's very macho trailer. And then when you watch the movie, I mean, not only is Quentin Tarantino's foot fetish gotten out of control in the movie, because like every single female character is barefoot and puts her feet up for like 10 minutes. And it's like, I'm just like, okay, dial it back. I know you did it in Jackie Brown. I know you did it in Kill Bill. I know, but you know, oh my God, you know, we get it.
I mean, when, the thing
you
is,
know, go
I
buy a magazine or
that.
Something.
Now I'm like, it's all I can see is like a weird collage of like Tarantino film feet, and I hadn't thought of it that way. Now, and I'm kind of going, now I kind of liked it, but now I'm wondering, do I have a foot problem too?
But the thing also with Margot Robbie in it, I mean, the female gaze is so present in this movie, and that is all her character is. And I could not figure out whether Quentin Tarantino just wanted to photograph Margot Robbie dancing all the time with no dialogue whatsoever, or he was trying to even make a statement about how Hollywood saw her, especially after her death in real life, how people have remembered her, because she is kind of iconic to that time and has such a notorious end. I couldn't tell which one it was, because he's done strong characters before. I mean, you know, Death Proof, even though it was a terrible movie, lots of strong female characters.
Yep.
You know, Kill Bill, huge female character. I mean, even Pulp Fiction had some good female characters in it. He hasn't done it recently because, you know, Django and then Hateful Eight, you really don't have very many female characters in those. But in terms of the strong female compelling characters, I mean, she's vacuous. And I don't want to sound like I'm an overly woke critic, but that sort of didn't play right to me, especially for it to being in the middle of the sexual revolution at the time.
Well, you mentioned Hateful Eight, and I got to say, anything that Jennifer Jason Leigh does, I think, is fantastic, and she was incredible in that part, though it wasn't the big strong woman scenario exactly, necessarily.
Yeah.
But I will say this about Robbie, and as she plays Sharon Tate, is I was amazed at what came across was the humanity of this girl who's an actress, and if anyone's been around actors in general, as strong as they may seem off-screen or on-screen, there is this self-conscious thing, there is this awkward, this maybe not the most competent issue that they're dealing with, and you see her humanity in a way that I think really shows her strength as an actress, and maybe that shows in his filmmaking because it comes across so well. At least I saw it, or maybe I just wanted to see it. I don't know.
I think that's more testament to her than necessarily Tarantino. Anyway, we got to grade this. So, you know, in the Fat Guy Show we do, it either rocks or it sucks, or you can say it kind of rocks or kind of sucks. So how what do you rate it?
I think it kind of rocks. I want to see it again. So it has to kind of rock if I want to see it again. I just don't know if I want to wait till it streams or if I actually want to go plop down another $250 or whatever it is to see a movie these days with the oversized, overpriced popcorn and supersized beverage with the catheter.
I'll not have the catheter. I'm also going to say it kind of rocks because it was compelling, but it certainly had its flaws.
There you go.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. Thanks so much to Sterling for being a guest reviewer.
Thanks.
And I got to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Box Office and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring the Universal Horror Collection Volume 2. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the box office here really quick. Last week, as I predicted, and I was predicting this for months, I said Lion King is just going to print money. It is going to be the last mega hit of the summer. And that's not to say that Once Upon a Time in Hollywood isn't going to do well, or Hobbs and Shaw, or anything like that. But I think that this is the last blockbuster. And I was absolutely right. I mean, regardless of what other critics say, that movie made $192 million last weekend. That is a July record. I actually said last week, I don't think it's going to break a record. It broke that record. That is an impressive number. And Spider-Man didn't even come close. Spider-Man came in with $21 million. And going into this weekend, The Lion King has made so much money, even just throughout the week. It's like at $260 million going into the weekend, and over $450 million overseas. That movie's going into the weekend, after a week in release, it's going into the weekend with $700 million plus. This movie's going to break $1 billion within 10 days from now. And that is impressive, especially considering how it was reported on Monday. And this is something I've raged about before. I saw all these stories and articles, and their headlines were stuff like Lion King soars at the box office in spite of bad reviews. And I remember saying, whoa. This is the problem with the current entertainment journalists now, who are like under 30, who forget what it was like to be an entertainment journalist 20 years ago. Critical success does not necessarily mean commercial success. A movie can have a great critical rating. It could have a 99% Rotten Tomatoes score and make no money whatsoever. And there are movies that have terrible Rotten Tomatoes scores that just get raked across the coals by the critics, and they make tons and tons of money. And I've actually heard people, well, but those don't hold up that well. No, that's absolute hogwash. You go back to the original reviews of Star Wars, and they were not great reviews. There were decent reviews, but they weren't great. Now everyone looks at it with reverence because it changed the world and it changed cinema. You look at even stuff like It's a Wonderful Life or John Carpenter's The Thing. These classic movies did not get met with good reviews necessarily. Reviews have never equated the same with box office. Now, there have been times where they can kind of push each other each way. You know, if the Marvel movies tend to do well, they tend to get good reviews and they tend to make a ton of money. But that doesn't mean that the critics are making people go see those movies. It can promote it. But get over yourself, film Twitter. Get over yourself, current journalistic people. I remember back in the 70s, critics would just do their reviews. They didn't care whether the movie did well or not. They didn't care. They just did their reviews. It's only in this Rotten Tomatoes culture where people are like, well, but it has such a low Rotten Tomatoes score. And even then, Lion King has like a 52%. Which is okay. That's not terrible. That's not like 0 or 20. It's middling reviews. Anyways, the other piece of news that happened this week is Avengers Endgame reached number one global box office of all time, and it beat out Avatar. And what's funny is a lot of people say, well, but you gotta remember there's inflation to be taken into account. Actually, Avengers several weeks ago surpassed the number of tickets sold to Avatar. It's just that at the time, Avatar, 80% of its tickets were 3D tickets, which are more expensive now than 2D tickets today. And like 75% of the Endgame tickets were for 2D. So actually, Avengers is a more successful movie, not just by the actual raw numbers, but also by ticket sales. So suck on that, James Cameron. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. First one I want to hit really quickly, because I want to get to the next one, is The Reptile. In this 1966 Hammer film, a quaint English town is haunted with murders by a mysterious creature.
In this remote little country village, the mortal remains of a man are laid to rest.
Who is it this time, Peter?
It's Mr. Spaulding. They found him this morning. Just like the others.
Just like the others, he died in the night.
Get away!
Suddenly, violently, horribly.
This is an evil place. Corrupt and evil.
Evil, as venomous as a snake.
Shout Factory is pulling up some of these older, sometimes a little more obscure titles out of the Hammer library. And that's great, because they're doing it. We'll be talking about this with the Universal movies here in a minute. Everyone knows Horror of Dracula, Curse of Frankenstein, The Mummy, all that kind of stuff that Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee did as best known for. But they're pulling up some of the more obscure stuff, the smaller movies. Hammer did a whole bunch of these, and The Reptile is one of them, and it's great to see. It's great to get this kind of given some new light. And it's a little bit of a corny movie. These Hammer movies kind of tend to follow a very similar path, where you get this quaint village that something bad's happening, and there's a stuffy old doctor there, and somebody's being oppressed there, and you gotta find out who's doing the killing or what's haunting the village. And that's essentially what this is, and it turns into a bit of a rubber monster, Wasp Woman kind of story, but it's still kind of fun to watch. If you like that sort of period piece Hammer films, this is worth checking out. It's a smaller, lesser known one, but it's still fun 60s schlock from Hammer, with stuff that is like supposed to be horrifying and includes some pretty disturbing elements to it. But it's so kind of stuffy and posh at times that it is sort of a unique flavor to it from the 60s. So I'm going to have to say The Reptile kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's hit the other title I want to talk about in the Home Cinema Roundup, and that is the Universal Horror Collection Volume 2. Now, it's from Shout Factory because they're collecting some smaller pieces that aren't being put on the big release slate, and Universal has sold some of their library. So it's still Universal movies, but it's released by Shout Factory, and it's four more classic films from the 1940s. Murders at the Zoo, The Mad Ghoul, The Strange Case of Dr. RX, and The Mad Doctor of Market Street, whose trailer we're going to hear right now.
You see, I've gone as far as I can in my scientific research among the lower animals. But it is obvious that my findings will not be accepted by the medical world until they have first been demonstrated upon a human being.
Thus dramatically begins the absorbing story of six human souls marooned on a savage island at the mercy of a mad scientist who claimed he could bring the dead back to life and needed victims to prove it.
The common factor in all of these four movies in this box set, whereas Volume 1 was they both starred Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff. Well, there aren't that many more of those floating around where Shout Factory had enough access to. So the connecting tissue on this one is generally Lionel Atwell, except he's not in The Mad Ghoul, but he's in the other three movies. And Lionel Atwell, before he kind of became the persona non grata in Hollywood for having too many orgies, Lionel Atwell was a very respected actor, and he showed up anytime you had like a police chief or a burgermeister or a stuffy professor or a mad scientist. He really worked for that. But Lionel Atwell, he was in Son of Frankenstein. He played the police chief whose arm was ripped off by the monster by Frankenstein the monster as a child, and he has the wooden arm, and he's sort of a staple in these old black and white darker sort of creepy movies, these horror films or adventures. Now the best one in the batch is Murders in the Zoo, and that one's sort of this murder mystery about this guy, almost a whodunit instead of a whodunit, about this guy who brings exotic animals over to America, and he has this zoo, and there's murders happening in it. And he's kind of a real dastardly guy, but you want to see how the police get him. And that one's really a solid movie. It's fun. All these run about an hour long, much like the previous volume. So that one's a good one. The Mad Ghoul's also not bad. It's a little bit silly. It does not have Lionel Atwell in it, but it has Evelyn Ankers, who was in the original Wolfman, and she was, I think, in one of the Mummy movies. She is a singer who is being followed along by this guy who ends up, this one doctor gives another guy, he puts him under a trance, and he needs to take fluid from a dead heart. It makes no sense. There's no science behind this. That one's okay. Then there's The Strange Case of Dr. X, which really is kind of, the transfer looks fantastic, but it's kind of one of those schizophrenic movies. It doesn't know whether it wants to be sort of this screwball detective rom-com or a horror movie. And then finally, The Mad Doctor of Market Street, which also stars Lionel Atwell as a crazy mad doctor, but it turns into, from a gothic horror story to a jungle adventure. They end up on a jungle island. Those are not the better ones, but the best one, of course, like his Murders in the Zoo. But still, all of them together, they're great sort of rare movies that you don't see elsewhere, and they're worth checking out. So I'm going to have to say the Universal Horror Collection Volume 2 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Other releases this week include Alita, Battle Angel, Hellboy, The Missing Link, Critters Attack, Do the Right Thing, The Criterion Collection, and 1984, The Criterion Collection. And that is it. I need to go for the week. And when I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Hobbs and Shaw. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.